Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of 342 Productions. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me as always is my co-host, Steve Jones Jr. Steve, how are you doing, sir?
Feeling good, feeling great. Happy to be here. Excited to be here. Thank you, Dunkers, for once again embracing your bounce. Tuesdays for the Dunkers, so YouTube, hi, hello. I didn't mean to take that from you, Nikias, but, you know, what's fair is fair. Go and smash that like button, comment. Got something special for you later in the episode, so no worries. But Nikias, it is time to hoop it up.
It is indeed time to hoop it up. Hope you're doing well. Glad you're doing well, friend. We are going to have a fun slate for you today. We're going to check in on a couple more contenders. We briefly mentioned the New York Knicks and the Los Angeles Clippers on the last Tuesday episode. But we haven't dove into them in Dunker Spot fashion since, you know, we had the early check-in in mid-November with the Clippers after the first four games of the James Harden experience. So fair to check in with them now since they are very, very, very good. And, you know, we talked about the New York Knicks in relation to the OG Anunoby trade and what's going on there. We haven't dove into them since then, so seems like a fair time to check in on both of those teams. Also has some W news following that. I think we're going to have some fun. So let's jump right into it. Let's talk about the New York Knicks, who as of recording on this Monday afternoon, they are 29 and 17, fourth in the East. They are a game back of Philly for third. They have won their last six games. Right now, they are seventh in offense, ninth in defense, sixth in net rating per cleaning the glass, if you want to remove garbage time. They are one of five teams right now that are in the top 10 in offensive and defensive rating per cleaning the glass. Featuring the Clippers, who we're going to talk about later, the Boston Celtics, the OKC Thunder, and the Philadelphia 76ers. So, Steve, can I start with a stat, actually?
I would not expect anything less than that, Nikias.
I'll be a stat boy real quick. But, like, I audibly laughed at my laptop as I was doing some prep earlier today. Because all throughout, like, Knicks Twitter and national media checking in on the Knicks, everyone's been kind of loosely citing the OG Anunoby plus minus stat. OG has played 500 minutes with the Knicks so far. They have won those minutes by 252 points. That is not how that's supposed to work. Steve, he already leads the Knicks in total plus minus. He has played 14 games. I think he has a 2-point lead on Jalen Brunson heading into Monday night's action. It is absurd for your team to be that successful. And obviously, we'll dig into the actual particulars of what OG's been able to do. But, like, that just blew me away. Because I've seen it. The net rating is even wilder. Plus 25 when I'm on. Minus 13.5 when I'm off per PvP stats. He has helped that team win basketball games. Beyond that, though. And I guess we can start with, I go OG-centric. My favorite thing about this Knicks group and something that I quietly have a question about. The OG plus bench unit has been fun to watch. Because I think about, you know, the history of this program. Whenever we talk about the Knicks, it's like this half-court offense is kind of a slog. They're playing slow. A lot of bully ball, a lot of ISO. Then the second unit comes in with like RJ and Emmanuel Quickley, et cetera. Now they're running all over the place. Like, hey, this is fun. It feels like the exact opposite of that right now. Where you have OG plus bench, you have Quentin Grimes, you got Deuce McBride, you got Josh Hart out there, Precious Achiuwa, to where they kind of need the transition offense because the half-court offense is kind of, we have some questions, and that'll bleed into a larger conversation, but the defense from that five-man group is insane. OG has been one of the best defenders in the league this year. Once you throw that in with the ball pressure that Deuce McBride brings, Quentin Grimes being solid on and off the ball, Precious Achiuwa, again, there are many things to point out with Precious on offense. And Knicks fans have gotten an early taste of the Precious Achiuwa experience. But defensively, he is a big that's comfortable switching. You can play him in more aggressive coverages if necessary. That's been a lot of fun. And Josh Hart just doesn't care who you are. He will get into your jersey. He's very physical. He can defend multiple positions. That groove just stifles you in a way that honestly makes me uncomfortable sometimes watching. Like, what are you supposed to do against this? They bother you, they bug you, they bump you, and then they switch if you try to get a screen to get one of those guys off of you. There isn't really anyone to pick at, per se. And, like, all of that popped in particular with the Saturday game against Miami, where we were hosting a watch party for that one. And I tweeted out after the first quarter, like, holy crap, Miami's offense actually looks good. This is fun. It's been a minute since Miami has done positive offense things. And from the second quarter onward, We didn't see that much fun from Miami's offense. And that second unit was a big part of it. But I've enjoyed watching that unit defend. I've enjoyed the Knicks overall, honestly. Jalen Brunson's had himself an incredible year. He's going to make an all-star team. Julius Randle, obviously going to be out for a little bit with the dislocated shoulder. But he's had a good season. You've talked a lot about his playmaking. But just the sheer physicality that he plays with offensively, I think that helps wear on opponents. And that bleeds into the other end of the floor as well. Isaiah Hartenstein has filled in admirably. And then since he's been out, Jericho Sims back into the fold now. He's had some fun minutes. I mentioned him in my screen time writing for the 342 newsletter. It wasn't the screener of the week, but he got a mention for some of the work that he's done recently. This is just a tough, fun, talented group. I think we should be paying more attention to the Knicks, which is probably funny coming from me, as you've been doing the pod with me for 3 years, but it's been a fun stretch for New York.
Long-term storytelling. Obviously, if you're a new dunker, hello, welcome. I'll give you a little bit of the lore if you're a long-term. This is interesting. Now, I am not surprised that you started out the Knicks talk by praising the defensive prowess of that bench unit, and we will tap right back into that here in a second. But Saturday, January 27th, 2024, Nekias Duncan tweeted the following: the Knicks are a tier two in the East and are probably a bench piece away from a stronger argument for being the second best team in the conference. Insanity, considering every year we've done this podcast, I have raised my hand and been like, hey, so the Knicks, though. And the Kai's been like, I mean... Yes.
They cool the offense, though.
Yeah, I don't want to misrepresent your words, but it's been some variety of yes, but also. Mm-hmm. And here we are, and then Julius Randle gets banged up immediately. They're 12-2 over the last 14 games. They've been incredible over this stretch. The two losses were combined 8 points. I think for me, larger picture-wise, it's tough because it's a fork in the road because Julius is going to be out. Obviously, there's optimism. It's not going to be as long-term as it may have appeared. Hopefully he's good because he's been so important for this team. But they've played their way into that four seed. That little grouping of them, Cleveland, Indiana, Miami, Orlando, them and the Cavs separated themselves. And then I looked up and I was like, oh, wait, they're a game out of three.
Yeah, they're right there.
Six of their next seven games are at home. So it's just about holding down the fort right now. We could circle back. But I do want to salute Julius Randle, who I believe is an all-star. This is where it's going to get interesting for them because one of the pieces of this season for the Knicks has been their ability to kind of handle each phase. Like, think about it. We've had Quentin Grimes be like, hey, man, where's the ball? Josh Hart was like, hey, man, where's the ball? You lose Mitch Robinson. Here comes Isaiah Hartenstein. You lose Hartenstein. Well, let's figure it out. Which
Taj Gibson, thank you for your service. Yeah, there you also, go. Hey, Jericho Sims is back.
Yeah, so I'm intrigued how they handle that lineup wise, number one, because, like, again, there are five players, I believe, averaging 20 points, 9 or more rebounds, and 5 assists. Alperen Şengün, Julius Randle, Joel Embiid, Giannis Antetokounmpo, and Nikola Jokic. One of those five people gets treated like the dragon meme. But now we're going to realize...
I wonder who that is.
Now we're going to realize how impactful he is. I do wonder which direction they go on. I don't know if you had any thoughts about it, but I'm thinking, do you insert one of Harder Grimes into the starting lineup? Do you slide Precious in and hope you can go double big for a little bit and let Sims take the backup 5 minutes? I don't know how they piece it together. I do feel like we will end up seeing more of Precious at the five with OG and Jalen and insert two of Dante, Hart, or Grimes in theory. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
If I had to guess, I'd probably lean Hart into the starting lineup. Mm. I think they go Hart and they just have like whoever you want to call the four between him and OG. In that group, I think they go there. I think they want to keep Precious on the bench.
It's fair.
Especially if you're playing Precious at the four with this group, it's kind of like, okay, what exactly is he going to do on offense? Because even if you think about like the theoretical spacing that Precious may provide, I go back to like the post All-Star stretch of about a year and a half ago at this point, where he's knocking out all these above the break threes and driving and stuff. Like, you feel that more with him at the five than you do at the four. If he's being defended by other forwards and other wings, like, I think that mutes the spacing aspect. of it. And again, this isn't a guy that's being defended like a pure stretch five anyway. But I think you mute some of that. And if you're putting the ball in his hands against fours with his propensity to attack and try to make things happen, that feels like we start Precious and he gets a super quick hook because he's done too much while Jalen Brunson is also waiting for the ball back. So I don't know. I see the argument for it in all seriousness, but I would imagine it's going to be one of Harden Grimes. And I imagine it'd be Hart, especially since if Randall's going to be out, like Hart should be able to do more of the ball handling things, grab and go, use him more of as a handoff hub. And so you can kind of mute some of the spacing concerns you have with Hart too with that. And then you can still just kind of blend in the second unit there. That'd be my guess.
Nah, I think you're spot on. I only asked that question because I want to be respectfully messy and be like, hey, did Precious get some Julius Randle tape and be like, hey, I can do this. Like, I know I can, I can do that. Anyways.
Extreme Sandy voice, no you ain't.
But back to your bench lineup point, because I think it's a good one. Number one, it was interesting to see them kind of initially start with like, hey, Jalen Brunson and OG, y'all do the bench. And then McBride was like, hey, I would like to play and continue to play for a very long time and stepped up. Watching Josh Hart, Quentin Grimes, and OG play defense at the same time is very fun. I think Precious has settled in to understanding what the task is defensively, which is the number one thing you need to do with Tibbs. And I think that activity, being able to mix in some switches if need be, I think it's a plus. I think if Josh Hart and Quentin Grimes had issues feeling involved, that lineup can solve that because they have no choice. We need you to do things with the ball in your hand. You will have the chance to do things with the ball in your hands. I know there are some playmaking concerns with that lineup. I think for me, it's more important for them to have to move the ball to a degree. Like, that group has to cut. That group has to try and drive. That group has to try and find it offensively. They have to work to create baskets. The other part is they have to work defensively to get stops, and then they can run in transition. It's like a different variety of that fire and ice that we've talked about with the Knicks second unit for the last couple of years, where this is just the defensive remix version of it. But I think it ties back to OG, man. OG really helps elevate their defense. When we talk about the Knicks, usually it's about the rotations and the scheme. You feel the impact of OG's ability on and off the ball to give them a boost. When his man is spaced, he can stunt and recover. That just helps. Driving angles that you thought you had aren't quite as there. Paint touches that you thought you had aren't really as solid as they were. When there's a breakdown, you can count on him to make the right read, to cover space, to naturally help guys rotate. I think that's so huge. His ability to navigate screens and take pressure off the bigs is big, but it also takes pressure off that weak side help that can tend to, how do I phrase this? I don't want to say stagnate, but it can get a little stale at times where, okay, we're in. Oh, are we back out? We're trying hard, but we're kind of struggling. I think OG just helps stabilize that. And you just feel it as they play more teams. Oh, yeah, he can guard a lot of people, huh?
Yeah.
Whoever's water we want to try and turn off, let's go ahead and do that. And I think that's also the plus of OG with the bench where, hey, quote-unquote sixth man or score or whoever you want to put with this unit to anchor it, here's OG. Deal with that. I think OG offensively has found his groove. I'm curious to see what your take is on how they've used him. But I've liked some of the movement sets as far as being able to get him off handoffs, a couple slices into the post. I think it keeps him a threat, but it also adds movement for the Knicks, which I think is always important, especially around Brunson and Randall. And you can find he's getting more comfortable when he's spaced, not just shooting threes, but, hey, I can drive a closeout. I can self-create, get to my pull-up. I can get to drive and kick. I think that's just such a plus for them. But, well, actually, do you have any OG thoughts offensively?
Yeah, I was about to say, just to jump in very quickly, I have enjoyed the usage for OG. It hasn't just been, it feels like they found the middle ground. Like, this isn't the OG gets 80 touches a game that, you know, if you believe any of the rumblings, reports, whatever, about OG wanting a bigger role while he was in Toronto. It isn't that. But it also isn't, you are our best and also most important shooter. We need to have you spaced. You don't get to do anything else unless you just find a cut or something. It's been a nice middle ground between that, to your point, coming off the staggers, coming off the handoffs, the slices into the post. And then something that we talked about when the trade was first made, as I had the early question, hey, how are they going to find that balance between letting OG explore a little bit while still fitting him within what they need. Him being the second unit guy was not something that I anticipated. And again, I do think there is room for a creation boost. And I felt that way before the Randle injury. With Randle out, now you definitely probably need to look into, hey, can we do something for an extra ball handler or something before the deadline? But even giving OG that room and letting him get some possessions there without Jalen Brunson on the floor, like, I think that's important to, one, placating him a bit, if you worry about that at all. Again, he hasn't agreed to an extension. He is a free agent this offseason, assuming he declines the player option. But also, like, you're getting him reps. You're getting him touches, and you're doing it in ways in which he's comfortable. Like, he's comfortable coming out for handoffs. I still laugh at, like, trying to balance OG on defense where you just cannot move him, and he can also slither across screens like a guard, and he can provide some secondary rim protection like a big, and he's good sliding his wings. And then on offense, when he drives, it feels like if the wind blows, he might fall over because of some of the balance stuff. So, like, that's something I just cannot wrap my head around. I don't know why he's so sturdy on one end, whatever. But he's comfortable coming off of handoffs. If they are able to tilt the defense with that second unit or when he's with the starters, he's a very willing and very good cutter. So he can find his own opportunities there. If you put a smaller dude on him, he is good at punishing smaller matchups. And the shooting speaks for itself. So I think the usage and also what he's been able to get out of that usage has been very positive during the Knicks stretch so far.
I'm with you there. But, you know, we can't talk about the Knicks without talking about Jalen Brunson.
Yeah, yeah. He seems to be good at basketball.
A lot of letter talk with Jalen Brunson. A lot of superstar talk. A lot of steak sauce talk. A lot of all-star talk. He's been great this season. But I think his impact is more important than a lot of the discussion goes to. 12 games in January, Nekias, so far. He scored 30 in 8 out of 12, including 6 of his last 7. I think the improvements that he's made to build on what he found last year has been huge. 45.3% from 3 on catch and shoot threes. 40.7% from 3 on pull-up threes. That's on 4.1 attempts. Last year, he was on 38% on 2.8 attempts. That's huge. Not to mention he's just shooting 41.3 on above the break threes. His ability to lead the dance has been so impressive this year. And I think that becomes more important in a playoff context because when you watch him, plays with his own pace, playing at his own tempo, getting paint touches, pick and roll, you now have to consider what do we do with him because of the comfort level that he has to where you don't know if it's going to be a reject. You don't know if it's going to be a pull-up three. You don't know if it's going to be a paint touch. It's a lot to deal with. And his footwork, the decisiveness, he's just been so sudden to where you don't know how quick that burst is going to be. Where's that hesitation going? What is he leading into? So even if you want to play a drop, hey, big has to react. Defense is holding and reacting. I think that's huge because and when we've seen it kind of just progress, especially over these last few matchups, his ability to get in the paint and score, and get to the pull-up and against drop, we've known that, right? Mm-hmm. If you're a defense, you want to show help, that's going to open things up for New York. And that, I feel like, is the most important part of this season for Jalen Brunson. The fact that, okay, if you want to load up against me one-on-one, that's fine. If I can get in the paint and pick and roll and now keep you engaged and hold the help and also create out of that, if I score at a well enough pace that you have to put 2 on the ball, I don't know how many teams are going to do it, but we've seen teams kind of sprinkling in throughout the season. You see every time what opens up for New York. And that's where I'm like, okay, this might change things in a playoff context. At the very least, if they can get defenses in rotation with the lineups they have of guys who are willing to catch and shoot, willing to drive some closeouts, does that open up a different layer for them offensively in the playoffs? Because I feel like the other counter was, we're going to show bodies, we're also going to put size and length on you. And again, going back to the wiggle or the improvement or just the pace that he plays with, he's felt much more comfortable against some of the wings that teams have tried to throw on him to where he's leading the dance and still getting to his spots. Does Brunson and his offense open up a different window for you with the Knicks in a playoff context offensively, or do they just kind of have the same struggles?
Like, I want to quickly bounce off of that because I think I don't really want to get into all the like 1A and
no, we're not doing that here. Tomato.
So we're not going to do that. I will say, and the only thing I'll say even related to that, is that your point about him drawing two and being able to open things up in, to that degree, I think that's the part of the like 1A conversation that he's more firmly put himself in. Because he is someone that has gotten so good at manipulating coverages. And that kind of circles back to even the pull-up growth for him. Not just in terms of the percentages, but the willingness to take these pull-up threes against drop. That was something that popped last year and is popping even more this year. The fact that now it's not just the floater and then some of the craft and getting fouls off of that when he gets in, you know, below the free throw line. Now it's, if I get a screen from Mitchell Robinson when he was healthy, Jericho Sims when he's in, Isaiah Hartenstein, if we get some of those super high step-up screens from 40 feet from the basket, as a big, I can't lumber around the free throw line and then wait to see what Jalen Brunson does or wait for my defender to get back and work back towards Jalen Brunson. He will take two dribbles, get to the three-point line, and fling it without thinking about it. And he does so at a high level. You have to creep up against Jalen Brunson now. And that opens up everything else. I laugh every time I watch a Knicks game. And, you know, it could be depending on the team or if it's just like second unit big comes in and they play that big more aggressively. Like I think about Milwaukee when they have Bobby Portis in. They generally bring him to the level. I laugh every time that the very first possession against Jalen Brunson when a big comes to the level. Jalen Brunson wins 90% of the time it happens. Oh, you're about to come up, huh? Reject. And then there's Jalen Brunson getting downhill again. It worked. Now, teams may adjust, or again, depending on who the big is, he may just have his way against that. But that first possession is always Jalen Brunson. He will trick you into something. He will reject, or he'll go towards it. He'll draw a foul off of it because you're too eager. You don't want him to get going, turn the corner. He's gotten so good that he's drawing that attention more. And that's an overwhelming positive. What's in my mind when it comes to Brunson getting two? Because I trust him navigating and then, well, navigating, manipulating, getting downhill to score for himself. I am keeping an eye on the passing because I think in a vacuum, him drawing two is a good thing. And then you think about the Knicks roster, your Dante DiVincenzo's. I really want to talk about him. He's just been really good for the Knicks this year. Well, they nailed that signing. I don't want that to go by the wayside.
Interesting.
Yeah, if only someone said that. Yeah, but he's been really good. But you think about the role players that they have. Dante DiVincenzo, good shooter, really good cutter. OG Anunoby, good shooter, really good cutter. Josh Hart, the shooting, question mark, but knows how to find space. And even if he doesn't find space as a cutter, I'll set this pin in for you. They have a bunch of role players on the roster that know what to do against advantages. I just want to see how consistently Jalen Brunson can nail those passes. To your point about not only is he seeing two more often, he's already getting a lengthier matchup in general, or within a playoff context, he's absolutely going to get a lengthier matchup. Plus maybe extra attention. I think the passing is really going to have to hit. Not that he can't do it, but that's something that I'm keeping my eye on moving forward and then heading into the playoffs with the Knicks. Because I think if he's able to navigate that portion in addition to, oh, I can just reject the screen, get downhill, then get to my floater or get to the rim or snake out and do whatever I need to do. I can get mine. If he's able to blend that with the playmaking and maintaining that inherent advantage, getting two holes in the ball, then yeah, I think the Knicks can be, even if they aren't like Indiana or Boston as a super elite offense, they will put points on the board. And if you allow them to set their defense with OG in tow and some of the guys they could bring in, they absolutely have a formula to make a deep playoff run. So I just want to keep an eye on the passing on that front.
I got a question when it comes to the playoff run, Nikias.
Okay.
What is their matchup? Who is their best matchup? I'm sure we probably could both raise our hands and say Cleveland, but I imagine Cleveland with like a measure or two or three of revenge.
That would be a revenge series indeed. Okay, so let's take a look at the standings very quickly. So I'm on my phone. My apologies.
You're good.
But as of right now, the Knicks are four. So their current path right now would be Cleveland in the first round. If you assume Boston beats Orlando, Orlando's the eight right now. We'll keep it standing for play-in stuff. So it would be New York and Cleveland, and then they would get Boston in the second round, more than likely. And if they're able to beat Boston, then they're getting the winner of Milwaukee-Philly. I would not favor them in a Boston matchup. Though I do think their physicality, and now you're throwing OG into this matchup too. Like, I do think they match up better today with Boston than they did at the beginning of the year. And if you're getting Mitchell Robinson back, Like, even with Mitchell Robinson being out a bunch, they're still top two in offensive rebound rate. They're still the best rebounding team in basketball. Like, they can still win the possession battle. That's a series that probably goes 6 or 7. I'll probably still pick Boston. So, like, if it stays the same right now, they're probably out in the second round for me. If they're able to get to 3, as we mentioned earlier, they are a game behind Philadelphia right now. If they get to 3, that path gets a lot more interesting. If you flip New York and Philadelphia right now, again, as of January 29th, before the games are played on Monday, you flip 3 and 4, you get New York, Indiana in the first round. Like, I would take the Knicks in that series. And if you're telling me it's New York versus Milwaukee, we have to see the Doc Rivers era literally starts today. So we will see what that looks like. And then if they are able to make a move to improve the defensive personnel by the trade deadline, I wouldn't blink at all if they beat the Bucks in the series right now. That could change, but like that, I think 3 is the pathway to them making the run.
So 3 is the pathway for you.
Yeah.
I in my mind, I'm thinking the Boston matchup. I think defensively, I feel better about them against Boston. I worry about them offensively in that matchup just because of the amount of defenders that Boston can throw or the defensive tactics they can throw there. And the fact that Kristaps Porzingis apparently just doesn't want to miss shots when he plays them plays a role there.
Another revenge series, yeah.
I'm thinking about Philadelphia. I'm thinking about the Knicks and a defensive game plan being able to sink into Milwaukee and Philadelphia. Not that it would be an automatic win, but I'm curious. Okay, what's your response going to be? Because, hey, are we just doubling Embiid? Are we just throwing all of our defenders at Tyrese Maxey? Are we throwing our defense at Dame? Which thing could the Knicks take away? Is where my brain goes to. I would be intrigued to see it. I feel like they're going to be annoying come playoff time. Granted, if they can hold on while Julius is out.
Yeah, and that's going to be the big thing. And again, like, I felt like they probably needed another, even in the tweet that you referenced earlier. Like, I think they are a bench piece away from having a stronger argument for the second best team in the conference. And like, even with the Julius injury, like, he's going to be back this year, unless something goes horribly wrong. We hope not. But he's going to be back. And so at full strength, I still think New York has an argument anywhere from 2 to 4 in the East right now. Just on the merit of how good they are. If they're able to turn the Evan Fournier and some draft capital into something that they could use this year. Whether that's, I would laugh if they make a trade for Malcolm Brogdon, considering the sixth man of the year conversation last year. I personally had quickly slightly ahead of Brogdon on my fake ballot. I don't have a real vote. But like, it would be funny after all of that conversation if they end up trading for Malcolm Brogdon. But like, if it's someone like that, and if the Grimes role slash comfort in New York thing isn't resolved, if it's Fournier plus Grimes to get a piece, can they turn that into a Brogdon? Can they turn that into a Jordan Clarkson or Jordan Clarkson and something if the salaries don't match up? I don't have salary stuff up right now. But if they can turn that into another bench creator, so even if you want to give Jalen Brunson a rest, you still want to rock with OG with the second unit, you have OG plus someone that can create alongside slash for him, and then the rest of that defense, that's a really fun group. I think New York's, they are in a good spot right now. They're in a good spot.
Perfect. I have one final thing.
Okay.
So I thought the stat you were going to mention was 19-0 against below 500 teams, 10-17 against 500 or above.
Talk about taking care of business. But also, yeah, I do have something else to, yeah. So like, you go through some of the Knicks stuff. if we're going to be Debbie Downer for like 3 minutes after all of the praise. So Steve mentioned the win-loss against, you know, the below 500 teams and above 500 teams. So as I normally do when I get like general stat stuff, I'll go to clean the glass, get filters out, garbage time, whatever. Mentioned earlier, they're 7th in offense, they're 9th in defense, they're 6th in net rating. In the half court, they're 16th in offense, they're 9th in defense. You want the half court offense to be a little bit better, but you know, we'll see what moves they make. When facing top 10 offenses or top 10 defenses, 26th in offense against top 10 defenses in the half court. That's a little bit concerning. When facing top 10 half-court offenses, 25th in defense. That is a bit concerning. And so, again, this is that's very much a year-long stat. If I had time since recording live, like I could filter for just since OG's been there and see what that part of it looks like. I would imagine that it's much better since OG's been there. So it may not be as big of a concern moving forward. And that's something I'm going to pay closer attention to moving forward. But like, that was something that popped off the page for me. Like, wait a minute. If we're just looking at quote unquote contender, like measurables and stuff like that. Like, that's something that doesn't bode well. And again, I think that's something that I'm just going to pay more attention to moving forward. That specific thing, that specific set of filters. But just something to keep an eye on. Not dooming the Knicks, but yeah, that caught me off guard.
That is what we call a feather in the cap. Remember that stat.
Yeah, if they overcome it, it's like, hey, there we go. And if they don't, it's like, that might have been a flag that could have been paid more attention to. But no, in all seriousness, shout out to the Knicks. And if we're getting into like one more things and stuff, I mentioned a little bit earlier, Dante DiVincenzo, what a signing that's been. His defense has been good. The on-ball pressure in particular has been fun. That man has been working. He's had to take on, you know, pre-OG, he's had to take on some assignments that you would want him a slot lower in the hierarchy defensively with some of the matchups that he's had to take on earlier in the year. But since OG's been there and he stepped into the starting lineup with RJ Barrett not being there anymore, he looks more comfortable. He's flying around. Again, what he's doing as a shooter, since the OG trade, 38% from three on 8 attempts is pretty freaking wild. What he does as a cutter, very willing screener on and off the ball. So they can mix in some randomness after the initial set breaks down or if it doesn't work. He just adds a level of energy that they need on both ends of the floor. I really think Dante should be highlighted for the work that he's done so far. And with Deuce, since the trade, 48% from 3-on-4 attempts. He has not seen a pull-up that he doesn't like yet. Really pesky at the point of attack. Like, he's someone that I've just generally wanted to see get more minutes in New York because I know he's a good guard, or I had the thought that he was a good guard, but the rotation wouldn't allow it. Especially when they had Emmanuel quickly, you got Jalen Brunson getting minutes, et cetera, et cetera. So even as I've said, they probably need some sort of upgrade in terms of bench creation. I have enjoyed the Deuce minutes so far, and I'm glad that he's getting this opportunity. And lastly, Isaiah Hartenstein, because I think it deserves a little bit more than he's filled in nicely for Mitchell Robinson. The rebounding, I still remember the conversations when he first got to New York as someone that was super high on Hartenstein. And in that first month or so, of playing the Knicks, it's like, ooh, that man is not grabbing boards. Tibbs does not seem to be enjoying his defense right now. Oh no, what's happening with this signing? And he's turned it around since then. And since Mitchell Robinson's been out, it is noteworthy to me that they've still been this good on the glass since Mitchell Robinson's been out. What he's been able to add as a high post hub, the defense has been solid enough. He's just a very fun bench piece. He's one of my favorite starter now, but he's been one of my favorite backup bigs in the league for quite some time, just because I love a big that can pass. The long-term dunkers know the newer ones, there you go. But seeing him fill this role admirably in New York, that's been a lot of fun for me as well. Just good stuff all around for the Knicks right now. Any closing Knicks thoughts? Or any more closing Knicks thoughts, rather?
Safe space?
Yeah.
Are the Knicks without Randall just the Iverson Sixers?
Wow. Wow. So if they trade for Brogdon, would he just be the Aaron McKee? I'm trying to flesh this out in real time. I don't know. That is a wild thought. Okay. With no further comments there, let's check in on the Los Angeles Clippers. Again, we tapped in with them for like an actual dive back in mid-November, November 13th, I think is when we recorded, and then the episode came out on the 14th, since Tuesdays are for the dunkers. At that time, the Clippers were 0-4 in the Harden era, and we had a long discussion about what's been working, what hasn't been working, some signs of progress that haven't really reflected in the stat sheet yet, et cetera, et cetera. Since then, the Los Angeles Clippers are 27-8. Overall, they are 27-12 since James Harden's debut. That seems pretty good. That 27-8 record is the best record in the West. They have the best offense in the league since that date. They have the 8th best defense in the league since that day. And you zoom out overall, the Clippers are 2nd in offense, they're 8th in defense, they're 3rd in net rating per clean the glass, which once again takes out garbage time. They're 3rd in half-court offense, they're 2nd in half-court defense. That's pretty darn good. And if you do the against top 10 offenses, defenses filter like I did for the Knicks, against top 10 offenses, they have the 4th best half-court offense in basketball. That seems pretty good as a playoff/contender indicator. Against top 10 offenses, they have the 5th best half-court defense in the league. That seems like a pretty darn good indicator if we're projecting them forward as a contender. So, Steve, I'll toss it to you very quickly. What stood out for you during this Clippers run, aside from James Harden being really freaking good?
What stood out for me, they figured it out. They kept playing. We talked about it early on. You mentioned the episode where we broke down the kind of the start, the trade, and everything. I think you go back and listen to it now and watch the Clippers play, and you'll see a whole lot of things, which is why I'm proud to do this podcast the way we do it. I think for me, it's the comfort that this team has playing together that's really showcased itself on both ends of the floor. You can see the comfort and the confidence. It's been, you know, it's replaced some of the tentativeness they had at the start to where they're trying to figure out the hierarchy. What do we run? What are we doing on defense? They've played their way through a lot of that. Because it's not just the James Harden factor, although he's helped elevate them. It's not just Kawhi Leonard not only being available, but being Kawhi Leonard. It's not just Paul George being more comfortable. Everything just kind of feels like it's coming together right now. And that really, it's been buzzing for me over this run because you mentioned how, you know, record-wise, how good they've been. 22-4 since December.
Woo.
Only losses at OKC, at home against Boston, at the Lakers, and at Minnesota. Kawhi was out for two of those. So for me, I look at a team that is just understanding who they are. When you watch them defensively, and, you know, some of this came from the Boston game they had where it was clear that they wanted that one. But you're reminded, oh, yeah, they have Kawhi Leonard and Paul George defensively. They have Terrence Mann who can defend multiple positions. They can navigate screens. They can switch when they need to. They're really good on and off the ball. So it makes it tough to know, okay, where exactly are we looking to attack? I think Mason Plumlee has done his job. I think him and Daniel Tice have a little bit more activity in pick and roll defensively than Zubac. That's not disrespect, just literally style of play. I think that helps to a degree. I think James Harden has done his part defensively. Yeah. Switch when I need to switch. Help when I need to help. Rotate when I need to rotate. You want to attack me? I'm going to work my tail off to keep the ball in front and contest. And if I don't, someone's going to help me behind. But that's important. They get stops. You know, we go back to the initial conversation we had. Would you rather have the offense be ahead of the defense or the defense be ahead of the offense? This is the payoff to where, okay, our defense wasn't bad at the start. It's getting better. We get stops. We actually run and flow into actions as opposed to, oh, it's shooting time. They'll still mix it in because the personnel, but it's not to the degree it was. We flow into actions, flow into pick and roll, flow into handoffs, flow into staggers. It's a lot more comfortable that way. And I think in the half court, it feels like guys are getting the ball in the right spots, much more comfortable. One of the points I had when we talked about this trade, or at least to start, how are you going to build this out offensively? And I think they've really found their rhythm as far as knowing, okay, what actions to run? What are we doing after the initial action doesn't pop? How do we keep playing out of it? Like, for me, heck, I'll even go to look at Norman Powell's play. Beyond statistics, how much more comfortable does he look working off ball, being involved, getting handoffs, being spaced? When you look at the way that they build out their elbow action to where James Harden can catch it, and we've got Kawhi Leonard on one side, we got Paul George on the other. We can do multiple things. We can get screening actions. If none of that works, we can flow to a pick and roll lower on the floor. Those kind of concepts are where I'm like, okay, the Clippers have figured things out. They're comfortable with where they're going to get it. And I think that's key. Like, Paul George has played really, really well to the point where we're talking all-star, right?
Yeah.
I personally.
At the very least, he's in the discussion.
He's in the discussion for it. I think that's so huge because, again, you can use Paul George in a lot of different ways, and they're finding their rhythm as far as how are we going to use him. Hey, it might be a pin down. It might be a stagger into a pick and roll. You know, he might be spaced and play off that way. Some of the drives that we're seeing from James Harden feels a lot more decisive now. Those paint touches feel big. And I think the key is the context for James. I have the room to do all of these things that I can do. I don't have to do all of these things that I can do. But when I want to, I can. Drive, drive, foul. Drive, drive, wiggle, step back. I can drive and kick. And he's just elevated that pick and roll. with the bigs, with Terrence Mann, being able to get the pocket pass and what that opens up for the Clippers, where defenses now have to help and rotate. Now they can play out of it. But it's not just that. Like, I think that's the important part for me. It's not just, oh, we can run pick and roll with James. We can get what we want. That's a part of what they do. I think that's the biggest part for me.
I got you. Like, I think the defense for sure just pops with this Clippers group. Just because when they are locked in, and we can use the Celtics game as the most recent example. But as we talked about in that episode two months ago, the Clippers defense was already good. It was the offense that was trying to work its way there. And then you add in James Harden and trying to get him in, as that was literally the start of his season. And he had to learn these players and learn the plays and also get himself into NBA playing shape. It was kind of rough. And now, as you mentioned, like, you made the transition point on that episode. And it pops now to where they at least know, they know what they're getting into. In addition to, these are really good players that have the ball in the open floor now, or that are filling lanes. Shout out Red Arrows. Now they know what they have a plan on top of that. It's nasty to deal with. And then the half court, I think about very basic thing, but I just think about just the level of space that you have around the James Harden pick and rolls. The Paul George staggers. When they blend in, Paul George coming off a stagger. Oh, wait, this is a Harden Kawhi pick and roll on this side while Paul George is going to the stagger. As a defense, you don't know, okay, when are they running this just to occupy us because they want to get the ball to Kawhi versus, holy crap, they're actually running this for Paul George. The fact that you don't know is part of the fun of doing that. And the fact that they're able to layer that in, okay, let's say it is the Kawhi post-up this time, which I have a question for you on that front. But let's say it is the Kawhi post-up this time. Where are you sending help from? And even before getting into where you're sending help from, how loaded up is your help if you have to think about multiple things with multiple good players at the same time? You really can't. And so, like, they aren't 13-14 Spursy in terms of the movement and stuff, but they can still bully your defense in the same way because they're really good. They space well, generally. And now, as they've gotten more comfortable with each other, as the sample has grown, they're now able to marry different actions. And to your point, like, Paul George has been very important to all of this. Because not only from a skill set perspective, you can ask him to do just about anything, he's also the star player that is super willing and very introspective about, okay, I'm fine with being used this way. Like, I think back to just some of, like, his own pod or when he's hopped on other things where he's felt, yeah, I know Kawhi's the best player on this team. That's fine. That's cool. I will just get in where I fit in. I'm really freaking good. I know I can take over when necessary, but oh, no, it's Kawhi. And I think he's had the same kind of, you know, he may feel like he's better than James Harden. He probably is. But, like, in general, oh, James can do the ball handling stuff. That's cool. I will come off ball. I know I'll get the ball anyway. Like, I don't have to worry about that. And, like, that's a small thing, but, like, that's an important thing. Because, like, not every star, as malleable as Paul George is, wants to be as malleable as Paul George is. He very well could have the right, I've been here, I'm really freaking good. Nah, Kawhi's one, I'm two. Figure out the rest. He's cool with dipping anywhere between 1 and 4 on the offensive hierarchy on any given possession. And because he's Paul George, he's still a threat like he's number one or number two. And that part has just been really fun for me to suss through. And then quickly on the defense front, you already hit on most of it, so I don't want to hang here too long. Just with Zubats being out, he's missed the last 6 with a calf injury, I believe is what it is. But I would just like to quickly say he was putting together a fringe all defense case this year before he went down. Like, I think he's been that good as an interior defender. He does not bring the same level of activity and, like, super aggression and pick and roll like Mason Plumlee, Daniel Tice does. So, like, that part is very much true. But what he was doing on the interior, I think he was very important for the Clippers having a good defense pre-James Harden trade. And even since Harden's got there, like, Zubac has been very good defensively. So I wanted to give him his flowers on that front. Well, I guess I'll let you comment to that before I ask my question.
No, I wasn't ready for that. Salute to Zoo. What was your question?
Okay, fair enough. My question is in regards to, again, they have the talent, they have spacing elements that they can make, you know, can make it really tough on defenses. With the post-ups and the ISOs for Kawhi in general, or I guess just a general note on their post-ups and ISOs, but with Kawhi as, like, the focal point of that, do you worry at all about their activity off the ball when they post up Kawhi? And I ask because something that's kind of been in my head watching the Clippers, that it hasn't really been like a big thing for me because they score a bunch. They've been one of the most effective post offenses in the league in particular this year. So it's not necessarily bad. It's more of a playoff question, to be clear. But like, I look at not just who they're spacing where, but like what they do as they're spaced. And it is a very static group. It is very much, okay, cool. If James Harden's making the entry pass, it's an entry to Kawhi, I'm standing here. Paul George may be two passes away, but I'm standing here. Terrence Mann may be in the weak side corner, I'm standing here. It's not a lot of, outside of like the big that may clear to like the dunker spot or something, there isn't a lot of movement until an actual pass is made or when the double team comes with Kawhi. Which, very quickly to that point, I have that in my notes. Among players that have posted up at least 75 times this year, that's a 34-player sample, Kawhi Leonard is double-teamed on the highest percentage of those possessions. He's double-teamed nearly 32% of the time when he posts up, which speaks to how good he is. But, like, also, that's a really big number. And, like, in theory, because of who the Clippers have around him, it shouldn't be as easy as it is, quote-unquote easy, because you're picking the poison there. But it shouldn't be as easy to send that volume of double teams to Kawhi. And like the fact that that doesn't really change, I can understand if it was Kawhi plus bench, let's double him a bunch. But like he sees a lot of those with the starters too. And like going through the Celtics game with you yesterday, and then today I was like, okay, let me just do the Nekias thing. Let's watch all of the Kawhi Leonard double teams. Let's just see what this looks like. And I just wanted, it just feels like there's some low-hanging fruit with some cuts to kind of free things up, especially when Russ is on the floor or when Terrence Mann is on the floor. Is that something that's registered for you at all? And do you have any worries about that in the playoff setting? Because I just feel like if teams are able to do that now, if you just get into a series and say, okay, cool, we're going to double Kawhi. We're going to pre-rotate to Paul George or James Harden if they're one pass away. We're going to force you to make this skip to bad shooter. And we're just okay with doing that. Am I galaxy braining it, or is that something that's kind of popped in your mind watching the clip?
No, you're not galaxy braining it. I think for me, there are enough times where the Clippers have used their space to their advantage, or Ty Lue has schemed something up for Kawhi in a way that I trust it enough, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Even something as small as going back to that Boston game, hey, Kawhi, here's a catch at the elbow. We're going to keep this right wing clear. We're going to dive and give you this space. That's where I'm like, okay, they can create space for him to a degree and keep, they have enough pressure points around him to where, yes, you could send help, but B, man does a pretty good job of cutting or being where he needs to be to where he's not necessarily that guy. And it's still James Harden and Paul George. I think there was a play when they played Toronto at home where they ran a stagger for Paul George while Kawhi was literally like, hey, give me the ball. And I don't know if they drew it up, but the way it worked out was timing-wise, Kawhi caught it. Toronto said, let's double. There was no one to rotate to James Harden who threw it to him. And so that's in my brain. It's like, okay, there's enough here to where you can see it. Also, when it comes to the playoffs, matchup hunting is always going to be a thing for the Clippers. So I think they will be prepared for that to a degree. And so for me, having Harden and Paul George as people that are one or two passes away helps me feel comfortable about it. Mm-hmm. And the willingness for them to move the ball to a degree to where, hey, it might get back to Kawhi, even if your first double is successful, kind of pops to me. What was your biggest takeaway where you're like, was it just like no one is moving and anyone could do this? Or like, hey, a really good defense could really get them out of here?
It's a little bit of both, but more so the, hey, nobody's really moving. And I think as I was, again, just going through those specific possessions when Kawhi gets doubled on the post. So it's not the larger sample of Kawhi post up. So very quick number on that. 1.06 points per possession on any trip featuring Kawhi post up. That is a good number. When Kawhi Leonard is double teamed, that drops to 0.88 points per possession, which is a very bad number. And so, again, going through the film, because you don't just take that number, obviously. But going through the film, it's like, okay, cool. You got Harden one pass away, or you got Paul George making an entry pass. If the second guy is Terrence Mann, or if it's a possession where, like, Daniel Tice is above the break and he's diving down, Tice might be the only guy that's moving. Or Terrence Mann to stay spaced above the break. Like, he's not diving in to clear more space. He's not setting a pin in or, like, setting up a flare for someone to come up. And then now instead of him being the second pass, now it's Paul George if James Harden threw the entry pass or whatever. And it's just like, okay, if you're not going to move, like, I think that's fine. And I think back to the conversation that we had when we had Jackson Frank on to talk about Embiid, and like, they weren't heavy movers off the ball with his post-ups either. And it was more important for them to set up, hey, you know where to throw the ball if the double comes, versus having a whole bunch of flares and exchanges and cuts or whatever. So it's not inherently bad that they don't move. But I just wonder, could a team scheme that?
I think a team could scheme it. I think my counter would be, it's good that the Clippers aren't solely basing everything off those doubles, if that makes sense, to where they can kind of shift things offensively and run different stuff. I think sometimes when it comes to defenses, one of the things that offenses do, or more teams are doing, okay, you have the rhythm on this action. You have the rhythm on what we're doing here. We're not going to run that for the next 2, 3, 4 times. Mm-hmm. We'll either run something else or try and get to it in a different way, and then we'll come back to it. Because I think a lot of what defense is timed on is rhythm and timing and anticipation. And because of the pace and tempo that teams are playing with, if you're able to now flow into something else, you kind of shift the defense's brain a little bit to where, hey, we're locked in on this. We got this tied in. Now, oh, we have to worry about this. Oh, they're back to this again. That type of beat. That's something I'm wrestling with when it comes to defenses and how offenses are trying to treat them right now. And I think for the Clippers, that would probably be their advantage or their counter, is that, okay, fine, well done. Let's do something else. We can always get back to it.
Okay. Just figured I'd get your thoughts on that one, good sir. Like, that's just, and again, this is very much through the playoff lens with the Clippers is where I have that question. Because if you zoom out, guess who, in terms of points per possession, is the most efficient post offense in basketball? It is the Los Angeles Clippers. In terms of isolation, they are number one in ISOs per 100 possessions, around 29 per 100 per second spectrum. They're fourth in ISOs. But in terms of double teams that they see, about 4% on isolations, that's eighth in the league. Nearly 20% double teams against post-ups, that's fourth. You know which team sees the highest rate of double teams on post-ups this year?
Who?
The Toronto Raptors.
Huh?
Yeah, that's a fun one.
I'm calling shenanigans. shenanigans.
That is very much, oh, Pascal has it. We don't care about anybody that y'all got out there. Oh, Scotty has it. We don't care about anybody that y'all got out there. So, like, even with, like, double team rate, all teams aren't made the same. Like, some of it is y'all are too good, and some of it is y'all are too good and also, which is where I feel like some of the Raptors fall into it with stuff like that. Because the top three is the Raptors, the Lakers, and the Timberwolves. Like, the Lakers make sense. They also have their own spacing stuff to sort out. And then with the Timberwolves, I'd imagine that's a lot of Cat. Or Ant when he gets a mismatch, and that isn't the best shooting team either. So, like, there's context to add with that. But the fact that the Clippers see that much attention is a good thing because of the talent that they have. But also, that's where my mind goes to, okay, what are you countering? Or how are you countering against these double teams? Because a lot of those possessions felt like Kawhi passes out, rotate to one, rotate to the second guy. And now the pass either goes to someone who the defense wants to shoot, or they're able to just recover if there's a catch and hold. And I just want the Clippers to be able to get the most out of those doubles if they're going to see that higher rate of them. So that's just kind of where my mind
is. Okay. Can I dive into the playoff context bag real quick?
Yes.
Something unlocked in my brain because ever since that Sixers-Raptors series, I always keep track of it in my mind of, hey, someone's guarding James Harden. Let's screen before James Harden gets a pick and roll so we can get a switch. So someone else is guarding James Harden and has to navigate that screen. And it made me think about switching. Do you feel confident about the Clippers against switches?
I feel more comfortable about the Clippers against switches, especially if Kawhi is going to play like this, which there's probably like a 30-minute pod to be had just on Kawhi alone and what he's been able to do.
Ah, so that MVP case is heating up. I see. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Hey, right, run that.
I don't know about all. I didn't go that far. Oh. But I'm sorry to disappoint. But no, he has been very good offensively. And I remember writing the piece earlier this year, like, hey, let's keep an eye on these Kawhi drives. They're not hitting the same right now.
Mm.
And then he immediately started hitting with the drives. It's like, ah, well, this is why I said I want to keep an eye on it versus Kawhi is washed and he's done, et cetera, et cetera. But like, I feel a little bit better about it. There is still kind of the inherent Kawhi and PG are like-sized. PG, Kawhi, Harden, depending on who's going to be defending them, those could all be switches. And then if you are factoring in like Terrence Mann to your closing lineup or Russ, who we should also talk about, who's played well off the bench and has been pretty fun defensively, which is a really high note for me because I have been frustrated with Russ's defense for a long time. But he should get a mention for what he's done. Also, just accepting the bench role. And that coincided with the Clippers taking off. Not one-to-one there, but like he should get his props for the year that he's had too. But if Russ is in or Terrence Mann is in and the team is going big and they can put their center on those guys, they're still just a general, okay, sure, you could use Terrence Mann as a screener. Is that not what the defense wants you to do then in that case? Are you not more okay with that than the inverse?
You might have, but Terrence Mann apparently has attended the unofficial James Harden pick and roll camp. Passes looking pretty good against Toronto and Boston. Hey.
That's true. That is true. But that's where I'm just like, okay, what? Again, it ties into the post-up thing, the ISO thing. Like, okay, what advantages are you going to create? Because I trust that they can win against switches. I guess for me, and maybe that's me just thinking too deeply into it, I want you to blow this defense up. If you're going to go matchup hunt in a way that, okay, we have to put two on the ball here. Okay. And then you're able to play out of that versus Paul George Kawhi or Harden Kawhi. This is a switch. We now stare at you. And you may score, which in the playoffs, that's all that matters. You just got to have more points than the other team by the end of the game. But just like conceptually, can you really bend defenses? Like, I don't feel like they've reached that point consistently enough for me. And then just very quickly looking at second spectrum in terms of points per possession against pick and roll switches. The Los Angeles Clippers are 28th. Only ahead of the Portland Trail Blazers and the Orlando Magic, who are dead last. So at least statistically, like, they haven't solved the switching part yet. I do feel like their process is a little bit better. And again, ultimately, they have the talent in the playoffs that even if it doesn't look great, they can score enough. But to, like, frankly answer the how good do I feel against the switches, like, they still have some stuff to solve for me.
Okay. On that front. That's fair. I had another question, but I'm glad you brought up Russell Westbrook because one of the points I wanted to make that I forgot to make when I talked about the comfort, the second unit, all those guys feel like they know exactly what they're in there to do. Daniel Tice, every single night, looks to be the happiest man ever as a Los Angeles Clipper. Russell Westbrook, it's competing, energy, effort. Man, they had that game against Brooklyn where they actually ran the small lineup and came back and won. It was just Russ the entire game being relentless. It's like, oh, yeah, nah, just buy-in. Norman Powell's been good.
You can still just do that, yeah.
I wanted to give them a hat tip, but I also wanted to ask, how much confidence do you have in their lineup versatility come playoff time?
It's another thing to where I am trending towards I like it, but I still have some quiet questions. And I'm glad you brought up the small lineup front because that was something that I wanted to make sure I had in my notes heading into this pod. So per Clean the Glass, the Clippers have had 411 possessions without a true big or center on the floor. So no Zubats, no Daniel Tice, no Mason Plumlee, no Diabate, etc. A plus 14.2 net rating in those possessions. That is really freaking good. And if you just filter for, let's make sure all three of Harden, Kawhi, PG on the floor with no big. So any combination of the two, Norman Powell and Russ, Norman Powell and Terrence Mann. You can sprinkle in some of the PJ Tucker possessions from earlier in the year. We're not seeing any more of those, it would appear. But plus 23 net rating in 168 possessions. That is really freaking good. And so for me, and you brought this up on the last YouTube pod, and it was one of those things where I trust that it's good. I don't want them to use it too much during the regular season. And then I also wonder, in a playoff setting, how many teams can they close against with that lineup? Because in the back of my mind, it's still just the rebounding at that point. And you brought up a great point, bringing up OKC, bringing up Minnesota. Like, you could probably trust Harden on a big or like the non-scorer in that group because he's so strong. And if you try to post him up, that's not ideal against James Harden. But I do still have the general, hey, are they going to be able to rebound well enough for this to matter? And that's where it came to like bringing up Denver as a counterexample. Like, obviously, nobody else in the league has a Jokic in the West. But like, can they do that against them if that's the Western Conference Finals or the second round, depending on how the seedings match up? So like, that's something that I'm keeping an eye on. I do feel better about it in general. Cause like when Zubats is in, you have more traditional pick and roll center, have more of a traditional interior defender. With Mason Plumlee, he can be more aggressive. You can use him in more of the handoff or post split stuff in a way that you can't with Zubats. Daniel Tice can fill gaps for you. He's probably more switchable than the other two bigs. So like, they can cycle into bigs, and then the small lineups hitting like this is a positive. It's more of a matchup deal for me now with when they can go to some of the stuff.
Okay. Okay. Because I was thinking they have multiple bigs who can do different things. They can go with the small lineup, obviously. Feel pretty comfortable with the contributions from your guards. So you can mix and match pretty well. So I was curious there. I'm glad you brought up matchups.
Let me get the standings back up. All right.
So right now, 3 seed, a game out of first. Mm-hmm. I'm going to ask you, how do I want to phrase this? Actually, I'm going to ask you this. Power rank these 4 matchups. It'll make sense in a second.
Okay.
For the Clippers in the playoffs.
Got you.
Oklahoma City, Minnesota, Denver, Phoenix.
In likelihood that the Clippers win or?
Just toughest. Toughest to easiest for you.
Ah, toughest to easiest. Denver 1, OKC 2, Phoenix 3, Minnesota 4.
Okay. I was curious because in my mind I was gonna initially be like, hey, is a Denver Phoenix path tougher than an OKC Minnesota path for the Clippers? But I wanted to get your gauge on it. I think Denver is the toughest matchup for them because of the Jokic factor combined with Jamal Murray and their defense and willingness to try different things. Phoenix, I'm in a weird place with because of the scoring, but also the Clippers may just be like, you know what? Let's go small. Let's switch. We can defend y'all. Or let's play a drop and you just take these pull-ups. Mm-hmm. Minnesota and OKC are intriguing because I feel like OKC has the type of offense that could keep the Clippers defense off balance to a degree at times. Mm-hmm. But the Clippers could also lock in a different way. And with Minnesota, for me, it's just Minnesota against switching. Like, I feel like the Clippers would be very comfortable switching in that matchup. And while Minnesota's answered a lot of those questions for me, mm-hmm. still got to see a little bit more as the season progresses. Mm-hmm. So that's where I was at. I figured I'd ask.
Got you. I mentioned a little bit earlier the Clippers 28th. Against pick and roll switches. The Wolves have worked their way up to 24th. I remember bringing them up early in the year on the episode we did with JJ. They were, I think, 30th at that point. So they have indeed worked up the list, but still bottom third of the league right now. Yeah, like it's just one of those, like, I feel bad for putting Minnesota 4th in that list. Because in the back of my mind, it's like, okay, yeah, like there are some offense questions with the Wolves. But, like, also, that defense is insane. And if the Clippers actually can't figure out the double team thing, that could get muggy. And it's not like Anthony Edwards is incapable of winning just a shot-making battle if it comes down to, like, the last 3 minutes. It's not like he can't do that. And they have a bunch of defenders to toss at all that perimeter talent that the Clippers have. Like, that very much feels like the Clippers bought down and as of recording, they are the number one team in the league in three-point percentage. If the Clippers have a bad shooting series against the Wolves, that could get hazy very quickly. So, like, I feel bad by having Minnesota 4. But, like, I do think they have more avenues to success than the Wolves do. I think that's where that goes. Honestly, I would like to see the Clippers against any of these teams, though. The Phoenix one is interesting in just the mid-range shot-making battle in teams that have a bunch of star talent that can't get to the rim for whatever reason. Also, very quickly, do you care about the Clippers still being bottom 10 in rim rate, or is that just a Nekias thing?
Nekias, we've done this for how many years now? 1,000% of Nekias thing. Now, could it be a concern? Absolutely. But I think the fact that they have different ways to get teams in rotation now or to force help mm-hmm. alleviates some of that for me to where, okay, you can get teams in rotation. Whereas my concern before, where I was aligned with you, was, okay, they're good once they get the ball moving, but what's their pressure point? How do they get a defense to alter things? I think that's probably the trade-off for me.
Got you. Okay. Well then, beyond that, any closing Clipper thoughts before we get into some news to close things? Quick Kobe Brown minutes.
Quick fun fact: the starting lineup of James Harden, Terrence Mann, Paul George, Kawhi Leonard, and Mason Plumlee 5-0. And shout out to Clippers legend Ralph Lawler, Lawler's Law. I dug this up on a rabbit hole. So, you know, first of 100 wins, right? Mm-hmm. That was Lawler's Law. Clippers are 28-1 when they do it this season.
Oh.
17-0 at home.
Oh.
There you go.
Not bad.
I did a stat thing.
There we go. And Lord, if we are roaming social media, that is the only law that's going to be referenced on this podcast. All right, so the All-Star starters were announced. In the East, Tyrese Halliburton, Damian Lillard, Jason Tatum, Giannis Antetokounmpo, and Joel Embiid. In the East, in the West, Luka Doncic, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, LeBron James, Kevin Durant, Nikola Jokic. Any surprises among the starter announcements?
Surprises, no. Well, actually, it's Shai. I'd be lying. Yeah. Shai, I didn't think Shai was going to overtake Steph. So I think, A, that's a great accomplishment for him, especially to get the recognition from the players and the media and to close the gap enough with the fans. I think that's neat to him, so that's a salute to him. I wouldn't say – I was not surprised by Dame getting voted in. I had him up there, but I understand it's been a lot of outcry and uproar for two people that will both be All-Stars. Which is a shame because this is what Dame's first time being voted in after narrowly missing to Luka in a similar fashion. So that would probably be the only surprise to me. What say you?
I think the one quibble that I had, Damian Lillard getting that second starting spot, that you are 100% right. And like the guy, like I would have had Jalen Brunson as a starter, and obviously he's going to make the team. So materially, it does not matter. But like as we talked about over the course of the last couple of weeks, as we were getting the All-Star returns in, once Trae Young took over the second guard spot, I didn't have a problem with it because he's been that good this year. But I even said on those pods, I just do not believe he's going to hold that spot once we get into the media / player voting. I thought it was going to end up being Brunson. And funny enough, if Brunson had more of the fan vote, Brunson would have got in. But he did not. He's going to be an All-Star anyway. So that's kind of like the one quibble I had. I had Luka and Shai. Like, I think it should have just been those two. I was curious to see where the front court was going to land between LeBron, KD, and Anthony Davis. We knew Jokic was going to be in, so just getting two of the three there. But no real surprise that AD falls out of that. He doesn't have the same creation burden. I do feel like the defense just needs to be talked about a little bit more, though. That man's been insane. But no real surprises there. We gave our reserve picks on the latest episode of The Old Man, The Three Things with JJ, so you can check that out if you like some fully fleshed out reasoning on that front. But do you want to quickly go through your reserves for who you had, or you just want to send the users on over to JJ?
First off, if you're listening or watching on YouTube, go ahead and comment with your reserves, and we'll do something fun with that to see what the common denominator is. Should we start out West, Nikias?
Sure.
Backcourt, I had Steph Curry, De'Aaron Fox. Frontcourt, Kawhi Leonard, Anthony Davis, Domantas Sabonis, wildcard Devin Booker, Anthony Edwards. And I said let's start out West because we had the same ones.
We did indeed have the same reserves, much to the amusement / chagrin of Steve. So that was fun. I can give my short list real quick. The people that were in strong consideration for getting one of the wild card spots at the very least. Paul George just missed out. Rudy Gobert, James Harden, Brandon Ingram, Lauri Markkanen, Victor Wembanyama, Chet Holmgren. They all got consideration from me. Ultimately, the reserves were the reserves, and Steve just listed them out. So they're all close. There's been a lot of good seasons in the West this year.
I can't wait to scan the comments and see what name you didn't say right now.
What about Jeremy Grant? What about Jalen Williams? No, the other one. but to the East, my reserves, Jalen Brunson, Tyrese Maxey in the backcourt, Julius Randle, Bam Adebayo, Jaylen Brown in the frontcourt, Donovan Mitchell and Trae Young were my wild cards. Paolo barely missed out for me. It's not entirely his fault. And we had a nice conversation with JJ about how do you feel about, you know, good teams, playoff teams, having to have a guy. I think Paolo's ultimately going to make the roster. And if you've been listening to the pod throughout the years, we did the all-star check-ins. Paolo has been on my roster. This is very much a late, okay, let's slide Paolo out because I feel better about some of these other guys. And I noted quickly on JJ's pod, like, the efficiency isn't quite there, but obviously contests can wave a lot of that away. There have been some injuries. And just in general, Orlando didn't have a bunch of shooting on the roster, so I don't super hold that part against them. Orlando losing the Paolo minutes is kind of concerning. And then comparing that to someone like Bam, who Miami's also lost his minutes after this recent skid. They are currently on the longest losing streak in the league at 6 games right now, so not great. But considering what Bam was doing to begin the year, also the responsibility that Bam has defensively that Paolo does not, I think both players have been the best players on their team respectively this year. So I gave Bam a little bit of an edge there. But like, those are kind of the factors where I'm like, has Paolo been better than Bam on aggregate this year? I couldn't get there. Same with Julius. Same with Jalen. And then once you get into the wild cards, like, Donovan Mitchell absolutely is going to make the team. And so it's kind of Paolo versus Trey. If you want to go more winning, well within your right to go Paolo, but that's where I landed on Trey because I think he's just been incredible this year. Paolo's on the short list. Jared Allen was also on the short list, especially what he's been able to do since Evan Mobley's been down. Scotty Barnes, someone that I had on my roster in earlier iterations, ultimately didn't make it, but I think he should be in the conversation still. Kristaps was a games played casualty, for those who remember. Like, I've been doing the whole who's played at least 79% of their team's games this year, kind of keep up with the games played minimum that's in effect this year. Very much a big brain to Kai's thing, whatever. You can yell at me for that if you want. But Kristaps is a guy that misses out on the games played front. Overall, he would very much be shortlist if not making it over Jalen, because I think he's been good for Boston. But those are my East reserves. What say you?
And boom, here come the Nets fans. I had Donovan Mitchell, Jalen Brunson, Julius Randle, Paolo Banchero, Bam Adebayo. Then I had Tyrese Maxey and Jaylen Brown. Trae Young was tough to leave off. I left him off. I probably imagine that he ends up being an all-star anyways, considering Julius Randle's going to be out for some time. Mm-hmm. The Jared Allen shout was one that I had considered and thought about. I'm trying to figure out, would Porzingis get in there? Like, who else would even – I'm trying to add to your short list. Mm-hmm. Is this going to be – okay, actually, let me ask a question real quick.
What's up?
What are you going to do when Jimmy Butler gets the nod?
Absolutely not. All due respect. All due respect. This is not an all-star Jimmy year. I'll just be frank about it. Everyone knows what Jimmy Butler can do when he ramps it up. He was just in the finals. We know what he can do. And even with some of the on-off stuff with him this year, like, the Heat performed better with him on. He has not been all-star Jimmy this year. He certainly has been playoff Jimmy this year. He's not in this conversation.
Mission accomplished.
I'm sorry. I don't know what to tell you. Oh, you know, a fun thing that I did as I was prepping for the JJ pod?
What'd you do?
And then we got the late text like, hey, guys, we're just going to do the reserve. It's like, oh. So I initially thought we were just going to give our, like, hypothetical all-star teams independent of, like, what's already been voted in on the starter front. And so naturally, I did like the games played minimum thing and everything like that I normally do.
Okay.
You know who would have missed out?
Who?
Just by virtue of that? Would have been no Embiid, because he's missed a bunch of games as of late. Embiid and Halliburton would have been out, in addition to Kristaps, just with the games played thing, which, again, naturally, they made the team. They deserve to make it, all the good stuff. So I was like, okay, let's do a thought exercise then. Who would be my reserves if we were just going to go with that whole situation? And so my starters would have been Brunson, Maxey, Tatum, Giannis, and Randle. He slides up. Then you got Trey and Dame in the backcourt, Paolo, Jalen, and Bam in the front court, Jared Allen and Donovan Mitchell as your wild cards, and then Scotty ends up being like first guy out. And then that short list would have Derek White, DeJounte, DeMar, Mikal. But, you know, that was me just thinking a whole bunch. So that part was fun.
Okay.
And let's close this out with some W news per ESPN. Free agent for Alana Smith from the Chicago Sky. Expect to sign a 2-year deal with the Minnesota Lynx. Average career highs across the board last year. 38 games, 35 starts, 9 points, converted 63% of her twos, nearly 7 rebounds, 2 assists, over a steal, and a block per game. She finished third in most improved voting. this past season. Really fun player. Are you surprised that it's Minnesota?
A little bit. But I like the signing. I like the fit a lot because I think, one, I like what Alana Smith can do on both ends. I think it fits what Minnesota does. I think she fits their style of play. I like the fit with Nafisa Collier, especially with Fee being able to space. I think the defense is really going to pop and help Minnesota on that end as far as, you know, being able to help weak side rotations. I think that's going to be very solid. The Lynx have been, like, in the back of my brain during this entire W free agency because they feel like they're lurking to a degree. But I wasn't sure how many of the names we have fit their specific timeline or which direction they would even want to go in. So this kind of feels like we're still building, but we're finding the people that we want to add to our core type of move as opposed to let's swing for the fences.
Makes sense. Like, I'd love, just from a basketball fit, Alana very much fits in with the way that they use their post as hubs. They're running through Nafisa. Jessica Shepherd's one of the best big passers in the league. They sprinkled it in with Dorca last year. Like, she's going to fit in like a glove doing that kind of stuff. And then defensively, being able to ramp up the aggression with her directly involved at the level, getting those deflections, forcing turnovers like that, that's going to be important for Minnesota to get out in transition, get some easy buckets there. And then, as you mentioned, when she's on the weak side, if you want to ramp it up elsewhere, she's very good at closing down space and challenging things at the rim or just stealing those passes if you're trying to make a skip. So I think that's going to be a hand-in-glove fit. I continue to keep an eye on, again, just where the shooting is going to land with Minnesota because they ultimately end up putting a lot of pressure on, you know, within the starters, Kayla McBride and Nafisa Collier to knock down those shots. And then as the season went on, like, some of the shooting for Fee in particular dropped. So we'll see where Atlanta lands on that front. But I like it. And Minnesota still has cap space to play with. So I wonder if they're able to add to that with another splashier name versus just bringing some of their free agents back. So we'll keep an eye on Minnesota. And then to close it out, a couple of re-signings. Leisha Clarendon expected to re-sign with the Sparks on a 2-year deal. That's coming from Rachel Galligan of Windsider. They averaged 11 points per game, 51% on twos, 46% on threes, but on low volume. 3 boards, 3 assists, and a steal in 24 starts. The Sparks went 14-10 once they entered the lineup. So I want to give a quick shout out there. Nasty defender. The drives, I felt, were very important for the Sparks, especially once some of the injuries started rolling in. So for them to have that kind of impact on both ends of the floor, I think was very important for the Sparks. Nice to see them back with the Sparks. And then Kalani Brown, we talked about on the last episode on Thursday. A lot of interest around the league. A lot of teams expressing interest in Kalani after the season that she put up for Dallas. Back in Dallas on a 2-year deal. First reported by Christina Williams. Dorta Gentry of The Athletic also chipped in with the multi-year portion of it. So I want to give credit to both of them. Surprised that Kalani's coming back or any thoughts on Leisha Clarendon?
I'm not surprised that Kalani's going back to Dallas. I think it was a really good fit. I was glad the intrigue was there. With Clarendon, my mind always goes to their impact in that game against the Aces and the competitive spirit, the ability to score, the ability to defend. And I think the Sparks just need as many culture fits as they can get right now as they are trying to figure out and shift. So being able to bring them back is huge. But it's ramping up, Nikias. I have a feeling we're about to hear some things this week.
Yeah, February 1st, right around the corner. That is the date that contracts can officially be signed. A negotiating period started about a week or so ago. So very excited for things to ramp up. Hopefully we have a whole bunch of fun things to talk about on Thursday on the W front. But with that, thank you for listening to and or watching this episode of The Dunker Spot. If you haven't already, please subscribe to us. We are on Apple, Spotify, Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your pods, you can find us. And naturally, if you're watching us on JJ Reddick's YouTube channel, and for some reason you aren't subscribed to JJ Reddick's YouTube channel, you should probably subscribe to JJ Reddick's YouTube channel. But you can follow me on Twitter at NikiasNBA. You can follow Steve on Twitter at SteveJones20. Join the Dunker Spot community on Twitter. We're having fun discussions in there. More importantly, though, join us for our online Dunker Spot watch parties. If you want to watch basketball with us, giving real-time analysis, live analysis, Steve breaking down end of quarter / overtime / buzzer beating plays, we're doing that live. So if you want to have some fun or just let your hair down and chill with a cool group of folks, we have really built a fun community. We get the life lessons in there. We vent about our jobs, all this good stuff. So If you want a safe space to talk some hoops and watch some hoops and learn some things about hoops along the way, come rock with us. The link is going to be in the description. Just click on that, enter information. If you have a league pass or cable subscription, you should be good to go. You can enter that in to create a profile. It's free, no shenanigans. And if it is a hyperlink for the audio listeners, just copy and paste that link into your browser. It is free, no shenanigans. And with that, we will catch y'all later in the week.
Hey, shout out to the Solo Sikoa hoodie, buddy. What's up, Bailey?